But I thought it was important for everybody to know and hear the kinds of things and the discussions that are going on. And we've had those kind of discussions here, and I appreciate the people who are here tonight to let us do that. So I will open up informational meeting on proposals to assist our counties considering what may happen with the reauthorization of the federal bill. So with that, Tim will come on up and introduce some of the people, and I'll let you kind of organize
that. Thank you,
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee. And I'll just take a minute with the introductions. I'm Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor, and at his direction I'm serving as Chair of the Task Force looking at the impact of the loss of federal forest payments on those counties who are most dependent on those payments, and how we, the state, partnering with the counties, both in shared funding and in the shared services that we partner with counties on, can help alleviate that situation. So we're looking at better ways of sharing and more effective ways of sharing, both on the funding side and the service delivery side. We, as we told you at our last presentation a month ago, have organized 10 different work groups looking at different program areas. Ideas from two of those work groups will be profiled in the testimony to follow, one from the assessment and taxation work group and the other from the law enforcement work group, the former being a way in which we can do things better with our counties generally, which obviously helps not only all counties, but is of particular assistance to the counties who are facing the most severe fiscal constraints from the loss of federal forest payments. The latter, on the law enforcement side, and in particular in regard to the medical examiner function, happens to impact the counties who are most affected by the loss of federal forest payments. We're not yet doing for those counties what we're doing for most other counties in the state. So it really is a good opportunity to say, here's something we can do that immediately helps those counties, even though it's a small amount. It still has a positive impact on their budget, and something we would like the state to be doing when we can find the money to do so. So 09, 11 probably. But with that, unless you have any questions from me on the general approach of the task force, I think your first panel will be on the assessment and taxation function, and that's headed by Karen Gregory from the Department of Revenue and others with her. I'll let them come forward.
Thank you. And thanks for being here. I was very impressed with your discussion at the last work group meeting from your committee. So it was really nice that you could be here tonight.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Revenue. And there are a couple of things that I'd like to do just to create a little bit of foundation for the conversation. First of all, I'd like to give you a very brief overview of assessment taxation in the property tax system and how that system is funded. And then I'd like from there to share with you how the local government groups came together to talk about how to shore up assessment and taxation. But my comments will be pretty brief, so I'll get started. As all of you know, the income tax program is really what we call the gasoline station for the general fund. The property tax system is the same for all the local governments. 1,400 local governments in the state are all funded through the property tax system. And as the handout shows, in this biennium, we're forecasted to have about $8.6 billion in property taxes collected over the two-year period. Now, the Department of Revenue has the overall supervisory authority for the property tax system, and the handout that you have simply shows all of the areas within the property tax system. It doesn't mean that the department does all of those things, but what it does mean is that we do have the overall supervisory authority for all of those things, and to make sure that all of those function work at least an adequate level at our state governments. I'm sorry, in the county governments. In the early 1980s, there was, as you'll recall, a pretty substantial recession in Oregon. And the property tax system found itself in disintegration. There were very large cuts in the assessment and taxation offices, and there were inequities in the system. And so in 1989, the legislature introduced what we call CAFA. And CAFA stands for the County Assessment Function Funding Account, and it was created to stop this disintegration. The sources for this CAFA account are a portion of document recording fees. $9 of every document recording fee goes into this CAFA account. And there's also a portion of delinquent interest that also goes into the account. So the counties collect these dollars, the dollars come into the state, and then the Department of Revenue basically takes it and refunds it back to the counties. And it goes back to the counties based on their percentage of assessment and taxation budget, their county apportionment to the statewide level. So if you have $100 million of statewide assessment and taxation, say, and a county has 3% of that, they'll get 3% of whatever's in the CAFA fund. So each year, every county submits their proposed assessment and taxation budget to the Department of Revenue. And if we agree that the proposed amount is adequate to fund assessment and taxation, then their CAFA is we certify their budget and they receive their CAFA apportionment in a quarterly basis. If the proposed budget is inadequate, we work very closely with the county to get it to a level of adequacy. And if we cannot agree on a budget, the department is required by statute to not allow the county to participate in receiving their portion of the CAFA monies. Now, those dollars, if they don't go to a county, may be portioned among the other 35 counties. If a county cannot adequately provide services, then the department has the obligation statutorily to go in and to do the function and to charge the county for the function. I'm happy to say that we've never had to do that. So far, the department has been able to work very closely with a number of counties, and we've been successful in reaching an agreement, and we've never not paid CAFA to any county. But, you know, today there are very different challenges. With the loss of the federal forest dollars, it's threatening to upset a very fragile balance that we have in the assessment and taxation arena. And we know that this budget season that we're in with the county governments is going to be very difficult. And we still have our statutory authorities to oversee the system. So seeing all of this in the horizon was really one of the reasons that the assessment and taxation group got together to start out with. We began taking a look at how to shore up assessment and taxation in October of 2007, and local governments and schools really joined in this discussion and left all of their interests at the door and came in to have a very open conversation as to what we could do to shore up their gas station of funding, if you will. And the folks who were a part of all of this, we had the community colleges, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, along with a number of county commissioners. We had the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, the Oregon School Board Association, Special Districts Association, and we had tax collectors and assessors. And the department facilitated the group, provided the meeting rooms, and basically the staff work. So we had four meetings. Folks came together and discussed and considered a number of additional revenue sources for assessment and taxation specifically. We brainstormed at least 15 ideas, and the group decided to really focus on ideas that they could be that could be accomplished in the near term. They didn't want to take on ideas that either had to go to the vote of the people. They wanted to do something that could actually be effective sooner rather than later. And they also decided that they would not bring forward recommendations unless there was a consensus among the group. There was a concept that enjoyed very broad support, and that was relooking at Measure 50. And the purpose for that was that the permanent rates in the counties are very, very different. They range from 60 cents in Curry County to $8.70 in Sherman County. So you have a very disparate group of permanent rates. You also have the double majority vote requirement. So both of those areas, as well as any reset of assessed value, were three of the areas that we discussed. And the group would certainly be interested in the governor's task force taking on Measure 50 and making potential changes to that. But that is not part of their recommendations. What they did agree on was that the property tax is the single most stable and significant source of local government revenue. They did agree that all delinquent interest on property taxes should be included in the CAFA account. And currently, those dollars, some already go to CAFA, but the other dollars go to local governments. So basically what they have done is really gone into their coffers and said, we will donate those dollars from our budgets and we'll put those into assessment and taxation. And that is about $15 million a year. They also recommended that they would like to pursue an increase in the state general fund participation for the funding of the statewide assessment and taxation system. And any additional funds, no matter where they come from, the group would want to see those funds go into the CAFA account and get distributed the way that they are today. And the purpose of that is, we're looking at federal forest issues today at the county level, but in the property tax system and assessment and taxation, there is always a push and pull. Oh, thank you very much. Pardon me. There are many issues that come forward that potentially could cause this kind of an issue with other counties that aren't federal forest counties. And I'll just give an example of the intangibles. Those of you who have been in the legislature for a period of time are probably aware of the intangible value that we charge, that we value in our utility companies. And many folks who have the utility lobby comes forward periodically and would like to not have intangible properties valued. It would lower their taxes, and it would be a real cut to the counties and local government if intangibles were not taxed. So that's just, I only bring that up because that's an example of another kind of disaster that could impact local government. That's why the suggestion is that you have the funding across all the board as it is today. There were other ideas that were brought forward. One of them was an administrative fee. One of them was increasing the recording fee. There was not consensus on either one of those. There were a number of other items that we'll be bringing forward to the governor's task force just to give them an idea of the universe, basically, that we did discuss. But basically, that's where we are today. We will bring our recommendations from that task group to the governor's task group on county funding for their consideration at their next meeting in March. So I thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. We kind of breezed through the CAFA program and the conversation about counties bringing forward their plan for assessment and taxation, and if the Department of Revenue doesn't approve, you have conversations to try to reach agreement, but by statute you have the authority. I guess it was when we got to the by statute, which is something that we could make adjustments in the course of the conversation. And I guess in fairness, I should tell you that I was a county commissioner for 12 years, so I have some residual issues with the assessment and taxation program, which often felt very arbitrary when the county in the course of a complex budget negotiation tried to find the best way to provide the whole scope of services, yet we were kind of hamstrung in even responding to recommendations from our assessor because we weren't meeting the criteria set by the state. So I'm wondering if that part of the conversation came into the work group discussion at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, actually that did not come into the work group, and it's probably because both county commissioners have had experiences with the CAFA. One of the county commissioners had been an assessor. And I absolutely understand your frustration with CAFA. I've been to a number of commission meetings and absolutely appreciate how when you're excuse me, when you're trying your best to balance the budget and then you have a program like the assessment and taxation that has certain specific criteria, it does make the commissioner's job even more difficult. I think that in some counties there is maneuverability, but as far as potential cuts, let's say, although I would say that today it's probably not the case. I'm not sure when you were a commissioner. What I'm saying is that there may have been more flexibility in being able to, maybe have a position or two less in a county at that time. Counties really have been cut to the bone in the last number of years. And our position is that if a county feels that they can do the work and do it to an adequate level, we're not going to tell them how to do the work. It's just that we need to make sure that through metrics we can see that the work is getting done.
Well, if Commissioner Lindley didn't raise the question, since he was a cohort of mine, I'm not going to pursue it, but I want it on the record.
I understand.
That I know that this has been an ongoing source of conversation, and I think it is part of the big picture.
I appreciate that. Representative Roblin, Representative Cowan, I do want to say I wasn't at every meeting, so it is possible that he brought it up and I wasn't there. But when I was, I did not hear that.
My question, I guess, is do we know from county to county, like the one thing that we've consistently found when we've gone out on trips is that if you get to know one county really well, then you know one county really well. And I keep pushing that over because finding one solution is not going to be the answer. But do we know approximately in this assessor taxation issue how much of the money comes from CAFA and how much comes from their general fund by counties? Is it fairly consistent or as a percentage of their budgets?
Well, Representative Roblin, since the CAFA is based on a percentage of the statewide budget, I'd say that it is relatively consistent. And if you don't mind, I'll turn around and
it's about 25-75.
It's about 25-75, but I believe that it's consistent percentage county to county. Correct?
Yes.
Which is pretty remarkable. We haven't found many of those. It's so the CAFA pays about 25%, and the general fund pays about 75%.
That is correct.
And that's what, I guess, where Gene was coming from, because in so many of the counties, when you have to cut the whole budget and then you look at this one and it stays the same, the others have to cut more to keep the percentage. And they look over at the assessor office and they haven't lost anybody. And the DA's office and the police and the sheriff's office and all those others had to take a bigger cut. So that's that issue of comparability. So approximately how much money annually does CAFA have totally? I'm trying to figure out what this $15 million and the $15 million, the $30 million we're talking about here, what percentage of the whole is that? How much would that increase the share to the counties?
If you were to increase the general fund by $15 million and you were to increase the delinquent interest by $15 million, you get to about a 60-40 split.
Oh, okay.
60 being CAFA, 40 being general fund.
Oh, okay. So it does switch that.
And that was really the dynamic that the local governments were interested in having, because the Department of Revenue considers CAFA a carrot, and I understand that perhaps the counties don't exactly see it that way.
Yeah. Call it a carrot, I call it a club.
I appreciate that. So we kind of wanted to have a larger carrot.
Yeah, I think they would appreciate that. I agree.
And local government really wanted to be able to make sure that they had a stable stream of revenue coming forward. And they couldn't do that if assessment and taxation were getting cut.
So what I'm hearing is that the conversation with respect to the other local governments was that as long as we keep in place this whole idea that we're going to have a CAFA and they're going to maintain standards for getting the work done, then we're willing to share that money. But we're not willing to share it if we don't keep doing the same amount of assessment.
I think that's a fair statement.
Okay. Representative Callen.
Along that same train of thought, then, the suggestion of an administrative fee didn't reach consensus, I understand, which kind of gets into the issue of the work to value property and collect taxes which support all 1,400 local governments is a burden that's assumed by the counties alone, and none of those local governments contribute to that effort. So it's another piece of the equation. I understand there wasn't consensus, but it is perhaps something that needs to be talked about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, it will be brought forward to the Governor's Task Force.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep, I appreciate your work. And I think, Gil, were you coming up to talk about the same issue?
If you wish, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Many of the items that you covered, you did a thorough job for a period of time. I just make a couple of comments. I here long enough to have been part of the creation of the CAFA system in 1989.
You need to identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Yes, of course. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I saw Phil Barnhart forget to do that today. So.
We all do.
I guess what I would add is I want to praise the other public stakeholder groups because they genuinely understand what's at risk. And we started, it wasn't really a negotiation. It was just an open discussion of what needed to be done. Everybody understood the problem, and they really pitched in, contributing delinquent interest amounts to the pot was a very significant breakthrough. Now, there are two other items that continue to maintain interest within the county family. One is the administrative fee, and the other is an increase in the assessor processing fee or the filing fee for documents for the county clerk. But the purpose of this exercise was to get everybody to agree, to lock arms, and say, "This, we will all go forward together and try to reduce the dissonance, the opposition to our final package." So those two items that are still floating around were not included in that. Let me say also that the system is built so there's tension. Tension is built in. You have three, in effect, competing interests that they all want the system to work well. Board of Commissioners, County Court on one hand, the Department of Revenue, and the County Assessor. But within that, there's divided interest. The Board of Commissioners, of course, has to provide money, the whole budget, all of the several services that are expected from counties, and they need to make decisions on how to provide resources for those. The assessor's focused on the assessor function, wants to do the best job of collection, and the department is trying to supervise the system. So the tension is healthy, and it has worked well, surprisingly well, since 1989. There has been stretches from time to time, and Commissioner Lindley did in fact bring that up in one of our meetings, and it's understood that there have been times when there have been discussions, and it's been close to fraying. But the situation we have now, the healthy tension is turning toxic for very obvious reasons, as you say. You literally have commissioners now having to face their constituents and say, the assessor's office will be held whole, but we're going to take patrols off the road. And it makes no sense to the constituents, and as a consequence, it makes no sense to the commissioners. But they're giving them credit. This is they've worked with this to this point, and have done, I think, a masterful job taking care of their fiduciary responsibility. I think with that, that's all I'd have to add. Just to, that you folks have worked hard at this, and it's clear you have an understanding and grasp of the issue.
Thank you. Any questions for Gil? We do have written testimony, and I think you saw that from the Lane County Assessor, Annette, I think it's Spickard, who was not able to be here tonight, but she did give us some of that same information and her perspectives on how it goes. And I would encourage you to look that over as you keep trying to figure out where we can find these little bits of money. I mean, I think the other context that we have to keep in mind is that if there is no reauthorization, we're talking about $200 million a year that these county governments are going to not have, and then throw in $30 million that the schools aren't going to get that goes into the general formula. We've got a ways to go with this $30 million. But it's this kind of stuff that I think that we started getting at least a little bit of flavor for, that enough of these make get you closer to the place where you can be. And many of the counties, especially those that are affected, have taken drastic measures already to get prepared for this. So they've set aside money. They've made difficult cuts. And I just want to make sure that people understand the scope of all of this as we keep going. As most of us up here know, but I think the public hasn't really completely understood it. And when I talk to my county commissioners, I think they try to explain it to people, but I don't think anybody's really ready for what's coming down the road. So with that, we would move on to... did you want to talk? Just have Major Brown come on up? Okay. Oh, and Karen, thanks.
For the record, I'm Dr. Karen Gunson. I'm a forensic pathologist, and I'm your state medical examiner. And I wanted to talk with Mr. Chair and committee members about a proposal to have the state assume the responsibility of the cost of the county medical examiner in each of the southern Oregon counties. That would include Jackson, Josephine, Douglas, Curry, Coos, Klamath, and Lake counties. Just a little background or history. The state medical examiner's office is governed by ORS 146, the medical examiner's law, and that law gave responsibilities to the state of providing forensic pathology services to the state, that is, the professional services provided by physicians. It gave the responsibility to the counties of providing death investigation, on-the-ground kind of investigation, if you will, in the form of deputy medical examiners who are lay investigators. Years ago, in the late 90s, the counties came together in Southern Oregon, Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas County, and formed a medical examiner district, which made their population greater than 200,000, I'm sorry. And at that point, the state medical examiner at that time, Dr. Luman, appointed a deputy state medical examiner who is a forensic pathologist, and that was Dr. Olson. However, the state medical examiner's office did not have the money to pay for Dr. Olson, and the counties each contracted with him to pay for his services. And that's how that district has been run, the county medical examiner has been run, since the late 90s. When I came to the state medical examiner's position, it occurred to me, as it must have occurred to many people, this was really not fair, because the state is providing forensic pathology services to all the other counties, albeit in the form of some, they have to transport it to my office, but I'm there for them, and there is no cost to them for me to provide my services. And so we have been pursuing remedy for this in the form of a contract that the state would pay to cover Dr. Olson's services. Currently, the counties pay $186,000 in aggregate per year to Dr. Olson for his services in their county. I am proposing a $300,000 biennial budget to cover this, and have actually, you know, had some conversation with Dr. Olson about this and have come to some agreement about this, and have plan on introducing a policy option package in the 09-11 budget that would cover this cost so that we could pick up the cost for the forensic pathology services for those counties. We feel that this is not is a duty of the state to do and is the intent of ORS 146. Briefly, that's it, but I can answer any questions that you might have.
So, okay, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a question, but I'm not sure. I've looked at the totals from Jackson, Josephine, Douglas. It comes up more than 187. What's the difference between those two numbers?
Representative Gilman and Chair, the difference is what they're paying for their deputy, like they have a chief deputy medical examiner, which the sheriff might pay for. And many of them also have to pay a fee to like a local funeral home or the local hospital when an autopsy is performed in that particular facility. And that has to, it's a small fee, but over time, you know, when you do a certain number of examinations there, it can add up. Now, in Douglas County, they have their own facility where Dr. Olson will do autopsies, and there's no, they own this facility. Also, the counties have the option of transporting their bodies to Central Point, where we have a morgue that's located at the Oregon State Police Patrol Office. So there is that option as well. And many times, for convenience of the county, mainly the law enforcement and district attorneys, Dr. Olson will actually go to, say, Lake County or Klamath County to perform the autopsy, because then there's not the cost ensued with overtime and so forth when they have to go to Central Point. So there is a bit of give and take there, but I certainly think we can alleviate some of the cost by providing Dr. Olson's services through state-paid contract.
Okay. So mine's a similar question. When I add up all of these on this chart, it comes up to about $492,000. And are all those services going to be covered with the $330,000 if we were to do that, or are they still going to have some county expenses?
Mr. Chair, they will still have some county expenses. The way that ORS 146 divides divides up the, right, sort of responsibilities, there would still be some responsibility for on-the-ground death investigation services by the county. That is to give them local control. They know their county better than I do, and I'm, you know, we, in order to alleviate all the expenses, Oregon State Police would have to basically develop a new sort of law enforcement or death investigation program with several deputies in every county to cover that.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. The other counties, Lane, for example, or Benton, do they have some costs then above what you're providing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, yes, they
okay.
do. In
yes.
fact, Lane County pays two full-time death investigators and two part-time death investigators. And as another example, Multnomah County pays seven full-time death investigators and a secretary and two morgue assistants. So there, the cost is not just to the southern Oregon counties. It's spread in every county. You know, I mean, every county has these types of costs. The larger counties have opted to have full-time death investigators, whereas the smaller counties often will use specially trained police officers, which my office trains for free for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Kahn.
Thank you. So if I'm understanding this correctly, Dr. Olson essentially performs the same service that you perform for other counties in that southern region.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, Dr. Olson is a forensic pathologist, and so his services include autopsy services, analysis of all that material that goes into that, court testimony, similar to what we do. We have more administrative responsibilities and cover a larger area, but yes, essentially he does the same things that we do.
So essentially, it looks like you kind of divide up the cost of his services. The savings vary from county to county size, according to size and need and that sort of thing. But we're looking at maybe a $30,000 to $60,000 savings per county, because other counties who rely on your services still, as you said, do employ a deputy medical exam. I mean, there obviously there has to be a human being there in the county to take care of things, and so that's kind of is that a close ballpark to what
yes,
we're looking
you
at
are
for
correct.
Savings? Okay.
Yes.
And I guess the other question I had, this memo that we got says, like, Jackson, $112,000 proposed for 08-09. So these are not biannual budgets. These are annual budgets.
Annual budgets. Correct, sir.
So you would be, the $330,000 is a biannual?
Yes, sir.
So we would be saving that, that $30,000 each year. So it's about a $60,000 biannually. But, okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking annual savings
exactly.
to county budgets.
Annual
here.
Savings to
yeah.
county, that's right. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? I mean, this is interesting how this morphed into what it is. And it's also very interesting that the counties of Ecuador are the ones that, with respect to ONC lands, are the ones that are going to be hit the hardest. I mean, it's almost a perfect match with some of those. There's a couple others down there that are close, but
yes.
when you threw in Lake and the others, that's about all of them.
That's correct, and I who knows how it happened that way, but we think we can provide some savings
okay.
for them in this program.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything you want to say?
No, sure. Dr. Gunson did a wonderful job.
So. Okay, that's great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, Paul is here. Paul Snyder, do you want to come on up? Thanks. Since you want to put all this together for us.
Oh, I think they already have.
Oh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon County, and I suspect that you already have in front of you our letter identifying the per-county costs. I would just simply like to express our appreciation to this committee for your interest and your willingness to help out with what may become a very major problem for the counties that rely on these federal forest receipts. I would also like to express that same appreciation to the governor for creating the task force and for Mr. Nesbitt for chairing the task force. A lot of good ideas, a lot of great dialogue came out of the previous meetings of this task force, and I think it's very important. It's very valuable. And it gives folks a sense of hope, which is in short supply these days, among the people who are most affected by this problem. What I did in response to the inquiry was to just make telephone calls to each of the counties listed and ask them to give us some information about the budgets. And what I got was what you have down there before you. I apologize that Jackson County is for the proposed 08-09 budget rather than the current budget, but it's substantially similar to what the current budget would have been. Apart from that, I'm here to answer any questions you'd like to have.
Some questions?
No.
You think you're okay with that? I guess that what I would ask is continue to be a part of that government task force, and if there's any ideas that haven't been surfaced, we need to keep seeing them. I mean, no matter how small, no matter where it comes from, I think the conversations that we've had already have been very productive with regard to coming up with monies. And if you really look at this one, there was also some discussions about transportation issues and those things. By the time you start putting all of that together, it starts to make that hope, I guess, is what you're doing. I still think, and I appreciate the previous conversation about Measure 5, and the disparity between, was it Sherman County at $8 and the 60 cents in Curry, and no ability to change that. I mean, that's the locked-in number. So hopefully we can have conversations about that as well. But I think these have been some of the most productive meetings with respect to actually having all these different people talk together and offer things on the table that I've been involved with. So I appreciate that, too. And I thank Tim for the same things and for the county's involvement. I mean, it's kind of like, how could we not be involved? But I think the fact that they've come with an open mind and are trying to figure out things, I appreciate whoever figured this one out, because I would never even known to ask the question. And our county's always had one, so I just thought that's what everybody did, you know. And I think it's only through that conversations that people realize that some counties are doing things very differently than other counties, and it might be helpful for us. Yeah, like I said, you know, one of the issues, you might not be able to answer that. Maybe I can ask some other people that same question. That has to do with if we change this medical examiner. Really, the person we're talking about is this, except Coos County doesn't use that doctor, does he? Do they? Oh, so they all use the same. Yeah. Yeah, come on back up. That's a good question. And thank you.
Thank you.
So all the questions, all the counties in question use the same?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have to tell you there's only 5 forensic pathologists in the state. We actually have our 6th one that we just hired. It took me 4 years to find him for Lane County. And we're planning on forming a district in Lane County with Lane, Lynn, and Benton County so that we can regionalize forensic pathology services around the state. And hopefully something for Central Oregon, but we'll see how that goes. So currently, we just barely have 6 forensic pathologists in the state. There's only 350 in the entire United States.
Right.
So we do have difficulties in finding qualified people to take these jobs, to take this particular job.
So in this particular case, what we would hope to do is the people would stay in the same place. It's just who is paying them would be different.
Correct. That is correct.
I like that.
They
okay.
will stay right where they are.
Because we wouldn't want to lose somebody if it's that tough to find them. Okay.
Correct. And I'd like to also emphasize that because it's a contract, it would not cost the state office anything more in infrastructure.
Okay.
We would not incur any extra costs by taking over this contract with Dr. Olson.
Okay.
Other than just getting it up and running, which we do on things like that on a daily basis.
And in theory, then, we would have one medical examining office and all these regional ones if you get these things set up.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here and for stepping up with some hopefully creative solutions to this. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the lack of folks in your profession that you've talked about. Tell me a little bit about where you got your training and your path to Oregon's medical examiner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I graduated from Oregon Health Sciences University, and I stayed there as a resident or trainee in anatomic and clinical pathology. And when I finished that program, I went straight to the state medical examiner's office here in Portland, or here in Oregon. And so I went there in 1985, and I've been there ever since. I was a deputy state medical examiner under Dr. Larry Luman until 1999 when I became the state medical examiner. One of the problems in forensic pathology, now it's not so much of a problem, but when I was choosing this profession, it was not widely known as a profession or a path in medicine. I think one of the barriers to people going into forensic pathology most of us work for governments, and so we don't quite make as much money as the hospital pathologists do. Mm-hmm. I'll make about half as much. And I think the other problem is frankly, lots of people don't like to deal with dead bodies and maggots and things like that. So, you know, there's that problem. But luckily, with the advent of CSI and some of these other programs.
That might have generated a little something.
We have a lot of, there's a lot of interest, and we have been having more and more people asked to come to my office to hear about forensic pathology, so I'm hopeful for the future.
Good. I think we were all wondering if television
would have. One of my old students from Rochester High School, and I like to point this out, is a writer for CSI Miami, so it's kind of fun.
Oh, really?
And started out with a couple other shows, but he's moved to there now.
So meanwhile, we have. Meanwhile, we have your door chain shut, so you can't.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to follow up on that.
So, you said we had three in the how many we have in the state?
We have a total of six. We have four forensic pathologists at the state medical examiner's office, and we have Dr. Dan Davis, who we just hired for Lane and Willamette Valley, and then Dr. Olson. There are others who don't work for the state, I would have to say, that are private or consulting forensic pathologists. Most of them are retired from other counties, other parts of the country.
Follow?
Yes.
It's not your job necessarily to know this, but of the six, how many are OHSU graduates?
Out of the six, three are OHSU graduates. Two of them in my office who I happen to have trained when they were there and brought them back.
I'm just wondering, sort of, not for our committee, but what we could do to encourage this field through OHSU so we get more. Anyway.
Yeah, it's... Well, I mean, and now, because of CSI, you've got public television with real medical examiners who are going on and saying that.
Not me yet.
No.
And it doesn't work quite the same way as on television.
No.
Does it?
Well, we appreciate it. And again, I really appreciate the whole idea that we had this come forward from people just to say, look, this doesn't make any sense, and we need to... The state needs to step up. And, I guess what I would encourage all of us to look at is that little shared responsibility charts that the county has that one of our members up here helped create a number of years ago. Because when things start happening at the counties, in particular those that are going to lose this money if the federal government doesn't follow through, they're looking at that same chart. And they're saying, you know, if we don't do if we don't do them, the state's going to have to take over so that we don't do it, and that's how they prioritize. And so we are going to get this back to us. Yes.
Can I follow up on that? I want to draw the committee's attention to, when you have a chance to look at this little chart that accompanied the Lane County presentation. And if you look at the items, the budgeted items here that have zero in the far right-hand column with no referral of general fund cuts, let's think a little bit about who's going to end up picking up some of these services. Women, infants and children, animal control service, basic health and safety for adults with developmental disabilities, emergency management, psychiatric services for severely mentally ill, health services for high-risk pregnant women and infants. You go down the list, the human beings that are attached to these services continue to live in our communities, and these are a frightening list of services that the county wouldn't be able to provide in terms of addiction treatments and a whole variety of things. So I think it's important that we read that pretty carefully.
Yeah, and I, you know, the one that I jumps out that you missed over was clinical disease control. I mean, I think...
Well, there you
just,
go.
It just keeps... Those are the ones that we take care of it and we don't notice that it's a problem. But once it goes away, it can become a really big problem very quickly for all of us because we just... pray that we don't have a problem, and then it happens, and everybody's affected. We also have some people visiting. Did you want to introduce them?
You'll like this. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Greg Williford. I'm my day job is the Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. My night job is a professor adjunct lecturer at Western Oregon University and some other places, and I have some of my students that are senior, junior criminal justice students here today. And I thought, you know, it's a class on management of law enforcement public safety organizations. I thought, what a better place to take them in February is when you all are here in session to talk about the policy process and some of the complicated issues that you are dealing with and that are certainly public safety issues and social justice issues. And so they're glad here to hear you today. So
thanks for coming. Anybody want to be a forensic scientist?
They all do. Thank you.
And I would say to them, just that, because you came in on this one, this is a rural policy committee, and the issue that we've really been looking at has to do with the federal forest payments that have been made to Oregon. When the federal government decided to not harvest as much, there was an instantaneous fall off in the money that went to our counties, and there's a group of counties that get hit very, very hard by that. And so the direct relationship to that is that if they don't reauthorize, the federal government doesn't pay us in lieu of taxes, basically, for the timber they're not harvesting, our counties lose about $200 million a year. And that money spread out means that in many of these counties, the number of people who are in their sheriff's offices and stuff goes way down. The jails go way down. The public health go way down because it's all about government is all about the employees, basically. That's where the costs are. And when they have those larger costs, which would be, I can't remember what we said, in some counties, it's as much as 60% of their general fund budget. And if that goes away, they cut things. And what you heard tonight, if you were here earlier, assessment taxation, they have a deal. That's something that they do for everybody. The state needs assessment taxation. The cities need assessment and taxation. But the counties provide the service. And so there's a built-in deal where you need to keep those people. So while these other groups are being cut, they kind of stay the same. And it creates tension between these different parts of government, which is very frustrating to us. Especially for those of us who believe that the federal government has made a public policy with respect to the forests, which they need to pay for if they're going to continue that public policy, or to look at harvesting at levels that would again start to produce the revenue off those forests that go to county governments. So it's an ongoing big discussion.
Mr. Chair, you well said, and it certainly represents a very good, real-life, complicated social issue for students like this to look at in real time. So it is. There'll be many of object lessons for tomorrow night's class when I have them back. So, but as the Deputy Superintendent of Oregon State Police, of course, we're participating in the Governor's Task Force on this.
Sure.
I didn't know if you had any questions, being that I am here. If not, just rest assured we're working with the Governor's Office to be part of working through this difficult issue.
You know, one of the things that I think came up in different conversations that, you know, our sheriff's offices are going down, and so one of the conversations was, and it looks like we're trying to work towards the 24/7 with the state police, but I guess that what I really want to make sure that people understand is they have different jobs.
That's right.
And so that we have them out there, there are a group of people in the public who believe that if we get 24/7, why do we need all the sheriffs? But their mission is totally different, and they supplement each other, and they help each other, but county roads and county areas are not the jurisdiction of you. I mean, you go and help. And I guess just a short explanation on the record would be helpful on that, because I think people get those confused.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're absolutely correct. They are distinct and differing roles. And we've worked for several years with cooperative policing with the counties, and that delineated even more succinctly the differences in our individual roles as state police, county sheriffs, or city policing, and including the district attorney's office, for that matter, as far as the greater criminal justice system. But they are unique, and as grateful as we are to see the restoration of minimal 24/7, that is built on allocation models that are for state and interstate highways and for the state police primary role of providing those services there, not taking into account additional calls for service deep into a county. So they are unique roles. We're certainly, you know, there to take hot, urgent 911 calls, but, you know, that's still going to be pretty minimal service, and it still may take a while because some counties are quite large, especially these affected by the timber revenues.
Any other questions? Thank you for being here, and thanks for having your students, and we appreciate you. being here as well.
Thank you.
Does anybody wish to testify back there? Is there anyone else that we didn't get a chance to hear from that's here tonight? Again, I want to express my thanks for the governor's task force and as we move forward. I will keep everybody on this committee as up to date with what's going on there, and we'll ship materials and as things come up. And again, if you have suggestions as we go on for stuff that you would like to know more about, please let me know so we can schedule those kinds of things as the interim goes along. And with that, we will close our meeting on the House Committee on Rural Policy.